You did it. Without watching a single playthrough, you won the game. You discovered the weakness of the last boss, and you won the boss fight. Now you've discovered what it's all about. Now you've found us. You've found the Similidudes. The Similidudes, comparing two unlike things, violating the very laws of nature for your entertainment. And now it's time for your hosts, the Similidudes themselves, in the flesh, Dave and Drew. Greetings and salutations. Welcome one and all to the Similidudes podcast, where we share an eclectic assortment of thoughts and theories about a new topic each week, all wrapped up in one overwrought simile. Finding the obvious and unlikely connections between two distant things. Believe me, folks, it's more fun than it sounds. My name is Dave, and with me, as always, is Drew. And Drew, I heard my Appalachian accent come through just a second there. Every now and again, it slips out. I am still a foreigner everywhere I go up here.
Yeah.
How are things way up there over in Saskatchewan?
Saskatchewan is all right. We are enjoying our summer month, and it's still a bit chilly right now. But no, things are going well. Things are going well.
Going well. You're enjoying that. A little window, the sliding window.
The little window. You have this little bit in the Midwest where, like, they definitely take all the pictures and do all the events during the summer, and then you just kind of board up your house for 7 months and just wait out the end of the snow. But we are not there yet. So, no, we're enjoying the outside, going for walks, looking at all the trees. Today I felt odd, and then I was looking at all the trees because they're different trees than where I grew up with, and
yeah,
it's weird moving to like a different ecosystem and seeing different things. Like the other day, this happened a long time ago, but we were walking down this trail, and all of a sudden there's this giant salamander. It's like a 6-inch salamander just crawling across the path in front of me, and like where I come from, you would not see a salamander just walking about unless it escaped from the pet store. And so I was like, what the heck? But there's all these wild salamanders out here, and they're giant, and they look really cool. And apparently before the winter, they burrow themselves into the mud, and they freeze completely and then thaw in the spring and come back to life.
Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have Netflix, it's a better way to spend the winter, I think. So, yeah, if we could figure out how to do that, just kind of drill into the mud and then just sleep for 7 months, that'd be pretty sweet.
I wouldn't mind that, to be honest with you, to wake up 7 months from now and whatever happens has happened and didn't have to go through it. That would be great.
Yeah, awesome. For sure.
So besides salamanders, what are you consuming? They're poisonous, aren't they, if you eat them?
I think so, yeah. They're kind of weird looking and bizarre, and I'm sure they have a lot of mysteries I don't understand. But no, I have been consuming Tolkien again. Good old John Ronald Reuel Tolkien, and today is his feast day, so I was celebrating that a bit. And I started, my wife and I have been rereading. I got her into rereading the series.
Oh, cool.
And so we are in the Old Forest, and we just met Tom Bombadil today, who is so great, but he gets cut out of everywhere. And
yeah.
I know why they cut him out, but he's just such a fun, like, oh, the first half of Fellowship, I think I've probably done this rant before, but the first half of Fellowship is so good. I want a movie that's just the first half of Fellowship.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the greatest things ever made. Mm-hmm. That all the music, the imagery, the way they set up the English. I mean, it's England, right? When he talks about the hobbits and the Shire, he's talking about, what would you call that? It's not quite, that's gentry England. Is that a word? Is that a...
I don't know. It's sort of like the yeoman farmers of you know, the the Midlands and the North and the places in England where I lived, it's just the farmland, right? And so you have like that farmland of England, and it's weird because rereading it now, I like see it through the lens of his life, but I also see it through the lens of that history. And so it was like for the first time reading through it again, and it's like, man, he loves describing walking through fields. And it's like, the dude was in World War One. Of course he does. Like, that was his life for those years. Like, what was World War One but walking through fields, getting gassed and shot? Like, that, but like okay. Most of like 99% of that experience was just walking through fields, right? And so it's like his description of going through brooks and through woods and through thickets and stuff, it's like that was, you know, like Belgium and France for him. Like, So yeah, like it's really neat rereading. It's like, oh yeah, he had to march here, there, and everywhere all across Europe.
Well, what do you make of the Old Forest then, in contradistinction?
Yeah, I would say the Old Forest is his World War One experience, because you have him in England in the beginning, and there's the similarities between Tolkien and Frodo in that they're both orphans, and they both have to sort of go on, and they go off into this world, and they're given this sort of unfair burden of life, and that's sort of what Tolkien's given, right? Because he was a part of this like sort of group of writers, and they all vowed like after the war they were going to be the next big thing, and that whoever lived had to carry the weight of them all, and then all of them died except Tolkien.
Oh my gosh.
Like so that's like the ring, like he has to bear the weight of all of that responsibility going forward in life. And so the Old Forest is like his wartime experience. And the reason that I will like double down on this is I was just reading today in the Old Forest, they get to a scene where suddenly there's a clearing in all of the darkness and the fog. And it's this clearing, and there's hemlock flowering, and he sees the light of the sky, and it's like this uplifting moment for a second. And there's this famous moment in Tolkien's life where during the war, he gets leave and goes back to his wife, and they go out into the forest, and she, by the flowering hemlock, does this dance, and that's what he like bases his whole sort of treatment of women
on.
This sort of idealized moment, and then, you know, they're right back into the Old Forest again. And so it really feels like that's his World War One experience, and it's just there's this haze and there's this fog, and they're marching and they can't kind of get through here or there. So yeah, that's my take at least.
I love the character of Bombadil myself, and especially how they describe him later on at the meeting in Rivendell. Mm-hmm. And why don't we let Tom Bombadil have? Well, he'll forget about it.
Yeah,
it's a really interesting, because it's Gandalf reminding the elf, you know, that's what will happen, and it's curious to me that A, the elf doesn't know that, and that B, Gandalf would actually tell him that he'll forget about it, that Gandalf knows more. Because Gandalf is actually, spoiler alert, he's actually one of the top created beings.
He's like a Maiar, whatever that means, or something like that. He's like a sort of demigodish figure.
Right, he's one of the close ones to the big god. I always forget his name.
Yeah, Ardu or something. I can't remember what his name is.
Yeah. Anyways, what do you make of Tom Bombadil, kind of a too long don't read kind of thing? What do you make of him being the guy who is sort of there at the very beginning and laughs at the whole thing, and he can put on the ring and it has zero effect on him, and then Gandalf's like, yeah, he'd forget about it.
Tom Bombadil is the reminder that the world keeps going on. I think Tom Bombadil is the personification of nature herself. And so there's that sense that we have as mortals of our own existential fear of like, but what's happening to us? And so we care about wars and all of these trifling human affairs. And what about nature? Nature just keeps living on past us, right? And so Bombadil is like nature incarnate in a person. That's why he doesn't care. He can just sing in the breeze and command the trees and all of that stuff, because it's like he doesn't have to worry about death. He doesn't have to worry about the affairs of men. You know, if all the nukes in the world go off, the cockroaches will still be singing their songs.
Right? Yes, that's very comforting. I like that a lot. Have you ever read Boris Pasternak, to go off on a jag, just a short one? Actually read Boris Pasternak?
No, I haven't.
I wonder. I'm going to have to reread now. Dr. Zhivago, the book, is a genius itself, but it's far different from the movie, which I find to be a work of genius too. But the two stories barely resemble each other. But he does a lot of that too. Oftentimes, Russia is under some sort of weather watch, as we would put it. And it's related to Laura and how Laura is symbolic of Russia as a girl. I'm curious now. That's enough of that, though.
What do you think about Bombadil?
I didn't really know what to make of him. I thought about him an awful lot. I like what you have there. I wouldn't disagree with it. And in any way, I'd probably think about it and add to it and pretend that I've made it up. But I like that he personifies. With Tolkien, it's awfully tricky because he is abject that it is not allegorical. And what you've done is the thing is typological. Oh, yeah. I call it typological. Typology and allegory are often confused and misunderstood. Well, typology is misunderstood. It's not one-to-one correlations.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's not quite symbolic as a lot of the work of that era is. So personify, I like the word personify. Incarnate is the way I would put it.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
To avoid allegorical stuff, which is C.S. Lewis.
Well, and he claims that he's like above allegory and that he hates allegory. I get hating allegory, but to me, if you were a human, you allegorize. What is rational thought except allegorizing two things and comparing two things?
Right, it might be like comparing two distant things for but careful. He really is careful about building ties.
Yeah,
otherwise, you end up doing this. Well, Aragorn is Jesus.
And you, yeah.
Well, no, because Aragorn isn't really Jesus. He's the king, and he's the king of kings in a way. So there's a relationship to the Christian view of the resurrected Jesus, but he's not Jesus. Otherwise, you've got the problem with Gandalf, who is like actually resurrected from the dead. Well, he's Jesus too. Well, no, now you can't have two Jesuses.
Well, but I think like he does this a lot with like characters where I think his way of getting around allegory is that he just multiplies it.
Yeah.
So exactly. it's like I don't know if that gets that's not allegorizing. So it's like the Blessed Virgin Mary is like Galadriel, but it's also Arwen kind of, and it's also Elbereth, and it's also like Eowyn. So you kind of have like all of these things kind of mixed together. So I don't know.
Well, I think that is kind of the definition of typology. When you're doing literary typology, that's exactly it, because you're spreading it around or compressing it, and you're trying to show what I call offices rather than a character, a one-to-one correlation to a real character real thing. You've got this idea of king, and Aragorn is it, and you've got this idea of whatever Gandalf would be, and he fulfills it, you know, rescuer from the dawn or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I try to do with Bombadil as well.
I don't know.
Is trying to find what he's representing. You know, what's his personification? Yeah. What's his incarnation? But I like that nature incarnate is good.
Because nature is at the expense of dragging this on further, and I can hear that you don't want me to.
No, I love it. I'm just trying to make sure we don't lose our Belgian listeners.
Nature is so important to Tolkien in his works, where like he's like Wordsworth that way, where it's like he has a lot of other religious imagery, but nature is this like primal, and I think that's a very English thing, where nature is this pure thing that is always being attacked and desolated by humans, but it endures and it is good and it is renewing.
And it seems to me anytime you come to a city, it's not really an industrial city, it's just a place where a lot of people live and buy the stuff that nature has done, and industry is even something done outside of the cities and is an abomination, like the bad wizard
Saruman.
And then the scouring of the Shire. He shows up in both places. I forgot about that. Sharky. What a great book.
great book. But what about you, Dave? What have you been consuming?
Well, I've been watching old TV shows.
Nice.
Talk shows from my childhood. I remember sneaking up in the middle of the night and watching Johnny Carson from behind my father's chair, and watched many of those things as a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, and then David Letterman hit. And he was my generation's muse, especially in the 80s with all his silliness. And I'm struck, and you and I kind of touched on this offline once not too long ago. I'm kind of struck by how mischievous David Letterman is. He's just a naughty boy. Whereas I feel like Johnny Carson, who is sort of like America's grandma or America's grandpa, right? I feel like he was subversive in his humor. Like I watched one today. He was interviewing Buddy Hackett, and he went on this diatribe on the justifying pornography. And I know this for a fact. He actually invited on one of the early porn stars and fawned over her. And David Letterman never did anything like that. He was just mischievous. Yeah. It was sort of 80s boyish stuff that he was doing. But I feel like and I'm not trying to cast – well, I am casting aspersions. I don't mean to just kind of the real Johnny Carson is evil. It's just – I just think he was subversive. I think he was part of that movement that subverted – what would you call them? The Anglo-Saxon mores – the Puritan mores of the Midwest.
It was that revolution of the 60s and 70s, really. In some ways, we always say the 60s, but really it kind of starts in 68 in some ways, or at least it picks up a lot of steam. And I think it really goes on into the 70s, and he was definitely a part of that. And I think Letterman's part of a more conservative, like, whoa, 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 hold your horses. Let's just get back kind of into the – but I think, too, you captured really well – those two dynamics, right? Where I think for a lot of people, late night TV was supposed to be for who, right? It was supposed to be for adults. And then it became something that little kids would watch that was supposed to be for adults. And so maybe Letterman just kind of reflects that shift in viewership.
Yeah. I mean, and it was always that those 80s, early, especially the early 80s shows were tuned. I mean, they were made for college age kids, which are, you know, just adolescents out of the house. You know, and then he grew up a little bit and it wasn't as good anymore. But that's a different rant for another day.
Yeah.
But that's what I've been consuming. And I go back and I've been watching it almost like an old person would, because Carson was made for the World War II guys. They were all adults and had become adults before their time kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he was very careful about it. He's so polite. Now, David Letterman was certainly not polite at all. And he broke down certain barriers that way. So watching it is sort of a going back to an old world where it was all class, but there was a kind of bite in the Johnny Carson 70s, 80s years. But when David Letterman came along, it was just wild 80s unleashed fun kind of stuff, throwing watermelons off of buildings and such and like making fun of the thing itself. And I've really come to use it as a way to calm down in these troubled times in which we are all in it together. So that's all I'm doing. Anyway, that's enough.
Cool.
But I did build a similitude around
it. Help me. Cool.
And I worked at it, and I don't think it's one of our strongest similitudes, but I like it anyway. It's one of those things where it's just like a little, you know, at the end of spring when you can go get your annuals to plant them in the garden, and you get there too late, and there's some sad looking sort of Charlie Brown impatiens or something like that, and you fall in love with them. I feel like this one is a wilted impatiens that maybe we can plant and bring to colored life.
Sure.
So here's my similitude proper. I want you to comment on this because I want to know what – because you came in the 90s, right?
Yep.
And so your experience with Letterman and Carson is I'd say considerably different from mine.
Yeah, for sure.
And we have now the plethora of talk shows, late night talk shows. Late night talk shows are like the dying embers of a fire.
Ooh, I like that. It's a very poetic image.
Well, I'm in that kind of groove right now.
No, I hear you. Late night talk shows are like the dying embers of a fire. Well, I think I'll do two little riffs here. One on late night, one on fire. And I'll do it backwards because I'm weird.
That's all right.
I think we've talked about before. I think we've really like come to this conclusion that at least Anglo-Saxon, but probably all of society, is based around the campfire, right? And so it's sort of like whatever happens during the day, we all want that experience of just kind of gathering around the fire. And what are the things that we like about that, right? You know, you gather around the fire, you hear music, you hear stories, you gather all your news, you tell some jokes, right? And you kind of relax and let the day just die. And so I think that's kind of it's the magic time of day. And the late night talk show is like, let's take all of those elements and merge them together into that pinnacle experience so that all of our society can gather around the fire and we can just have that chat, right? And so, like, it has to be bipartisan. It has to be, you know, aphilosophical. It has to be just, like, let's just gather around the casserole and dish, right? And I think that's the neat thing about a late night talk show and about a fire, that you just kind of gather around and there's no bar of entry to get in, right? And so it's one of those things where it's just open to everyone. And it's, you sit down and you befriend people. And I think that's what's so neat about the hosts too. And I think probably it's much truer now than it was probably in days gone by. But I think nowadays, talk show hosts and stuff like that, like late night hosts, are more like the only friend that people have. Like, right? Like, for a lot of people nowadays, it's like there is no fire. There is no friends to gather around with because we're all quite isolated in different jobs, and we all, you know, people move here, there, and everywhere and don't get to see those people. So the late night host becomes your like fill-in friend, your kind of the word is surrogate. That's the word I was looking for. Surrogate. Sorry. So the late night show host becomes your surrogate best friend, right? You can sit down with Johnny and you can listen to him, and he's smart and he'll tell you about all the stuff that you don't have time to read in the paper. And it'll make it entertaining and fun. And then you don't have to listen to all the different comedians. You can just hear the best ones that are on, you know, Carson or Letterman. That's like the bar for entry into the comedy world, right? Is that you got to sit on one of those shows. So I think that's kind of the same, right? And so if you have to distill everything together into this welcome pinnacle experience of the day, that helps you unwind, I think that's what the late night shows did so well. And I think they stopped doing it well when they started reflecting all of the other divisions. So you had to have, so it was great when they were monolithic, right? Like popes, you can only have one. And so as long as you had Carson and then Letterman, that was fine. But then Leno kind of wrecked it. And then Conan really wrecked it. And then suddenly we're getting all these different guys. And they're even kind of, they're sort of fighting with one another. And they have slightly different takes and different feels to them. And then you're just seeing the fragmentation of society again reflected in the shows. And so I felt like by the time I came to late night shows, they didn't have that same magisterial authority that Letterman and Carson had, because they were the unquestioned late night shows.
Magisterial. Yeah, and that's when Letterman lost it, was when he moved his slot from being the follow-up to Carson to being a competitor with Leno. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like he was anywhere near as good. And I think a lot of people agree with me. I like that a lot. I like what you've done with that an awful lot. It resembles what I had in mind. But this is why I like this teamwork thing, where I shoot you something over that's sort of nascent and barely conceived, and you take it and mold it into a fully formed Pinocchio. It's awesome. It's just great. I was going for something like the way your nighttime metaphor was just perfect, I thought. But just like, it's the end of the day. Because what I was puzzling over – here's the where the question comes from. What I was puzzling over is why would you want to go to bed after being stimulated by laughter, music? The music is always top. You know, like it's just – it's not something you want to go to bed by. I wouldn't listen to that kind of music in a live setting to go to sleep, to fall asleep to the jazz, the kind of the big band standard jazz, chart jazz that Carson had, and then that full-on rock that Paul Schaefer was doing with Letterman. Why would you do that? And I was just thinking, like, this is kind of like – it's kind of like the dying embers of a fire. They're not doing anything really, and that's why you can. The fire is done with its job. It's not heating really anymore. It's just dying embers. It's not cooking anything. It's dying. And the same thing with the stars coming out on the TV shows. There's nothing really of consequence happening. It's not the news. It's not really the sitcom or the drama where there's some new idea being expressed or explored or human, you know, the human condition. It's just, let's just sit down together. I like that a lot. The whole, we're going to sit together. We're going to tell some stories. We're going to tell some jokes and we're going to have some music and we can all do it together. Right. And we did for a generation or two.
Yep.
Anyway, I like yours a lot. That was really good. Thank you so much. Oh,
thank you. I also was going to say I have to admit, Letterman was on when I was growing up and I remember watching Letterman, but amongst my group of friends, for whatever reason, Conan was the guy that we went to.
Sure.
So we would never watch anyone but Conan. And so, or we would try not to. And so we would always watch Conan. And by then I felt like what he did was totally different from the late show, even though it had like the same format by and large, it was still so different, where Conan was much more, I felt it was much more like a singular comedy routine. Like it was almost like low budget SNL or like sort of like vaudeville SNL rather than, you know, if you watch Letterman and Carson, they're appealing to all the different things, right? So it's like they have really good comedy. That's good comedy. But then they have like zoo animals and they have like music and they'll bring, you know, politicians on even. And so it's like you'll hear all sorts of different stuff. It's not just it's not just comedy. They're not just trying to make you laugh, although that's obviously an important part of it.
So, I think one of the things that really made Johnny Carson great was that he bombed regularly and it was part of the joke. That the joke didn't work, you know, because that was just it. We're just kind of all here. I love it. It wasn't a low budget SNL. It was a guy standing up trying to make some funny about something that happened that it made the paper, you know, and his writers worked hard. And then, you know, when it didn't work, and that's what made him a genius, was when it didn't work, he made it work somehow. And it was a running thing. Oh, just beautiful stuff. And he had just the biggest heart for his guests. It's one of the things he's noted for, is having a heartfelt desire that you do well, which is a little bit like this first story you've gotten for us, that you have a city mayor in Belgium who had a heart that his city would do well, and they took it literally. What?
Yes. So this story is from the BBC and September 1st, and it's heart of Belgian city mayor found entombed in fountain.
How did you find this story? Oh my!
This was great because, you know what? This is Similidudes. We like to, you know, rip Belgium every once in a while. And so I was looking for odd news today, and I just on a whim thought, you know what? I'm going to see what's happening in Belgium. This was the first news story that came up. I kid you not. This was the biggest news today in Belgium. So I was like, this is awesome. So
look, our dear waffle making friends, you're supposed to like not do this literally.
So the best part of this story, so it's this town, Verviers in eastern Belgium. It's a very French part of the country. And I guess there was this mayor. He was a well-beloved mayor, died in 1839. And he had said that he wanted to leave his heart for the city or something like that. And there was an urban legend then amongst the city that this memorial fountain in the center had his heart secretly stowed somewhere. So this is the type of like story I imagine kids on the playground would tell each other, right? Like, oh, you know, old man so-and-so's heart is in the fountain somewhere.
Exactly.
And it's like, yeah.
And if you listen, it beats and it will come and get you if you're not in bed on time.
Because like every town has that story, right?
Yeah.
Like there's always some type of – so it's kind of neat. It's like, okay, that was sort of his story, right? But then out of the blue, They basically were just refurbishing the fountain, and they find this box inside the fountain. It's this zinc box, and it looks kind of like a casket, almost like a coffin, inside the fountain. And inside is the literal heart of the mayor. And they said it was surprisingly well preserved.
Well, I don't know.
Which begs the question, like, how many other century-old hearts have you unentombed to compare it to? Like, that's a bizarre description. But
yeah, surprisingly well-preserved for a heart. Okay. Oh, man, those Belgians.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a pretty cool – so I guess maybe the moral of kind of the news story is there might be more than a kernel of truth to some of these urban legends we tell.
I guess so. I like this line at the very end – well, it's in the middle somewhere. Mayor Pierre David died in a fall, aged 68, while working in his hayloft.
Hmm.
Did he fall on his pitchfork? And pierced his heart, and that's how they got it, or what?
I feel like in the 19th century, like, death was more like tripping on your shoelaces than it was like some catastrophic thing.
I know.
Like, people are just dropping left. I mean, like, when an infected paper cut could kill you in those days. So it's like, you just, they probably didn't do a lot of, despite Sherlock Holmes, they probably didn't do a lot of investigating, right?
Could it be any more Victorian era than this? I know it's not England, but
yeah, same idea.
Can you be a mayor of a city, die at age 68, falling on your pitchfork from a hayloft, and your citizens take your heart and put it in a box? I mean, that's right out of the Victorian era. When did she become queen? When did she rise to the throne?
Was it 39? I'm totally embarrassing myself. I think it's 37.
Oh, my word. It's perfect. It's perfect. Yeah. It is so 19th century.
37, that was it. Yeah.
Oh, whew.
Yeah.
Good.
No, I know. It's so, like, perfect of that era. And it's just kind of – it's kind of quirky, kind of weird. And I also really wonder who is the one who actually did it. Like, they must have taken it upon themselves to carry out this last request or whatever.
I mean, really, his family must have agreed to it.
Yeah.
Or maybe they didn't. But they must have at least said there was some sort of conversation about it. We are going to take your husband, father, grandfather's heart and put it in a box. And, you know, someone assented to this. Someone in authority assented to this. You know, we're gonna do this.
Yeah.
Because you can't just do this in the middle of the night. They probably had some sort of a ceremony and everything, right?
I guess. It was obviously, like, cloaked in mystery because only the oral tradition existed.
Interesting. Well, maybe it was a little bit more under the
so many questions.
We've had this problem with Belgium before, like with the lion.
Yeah.
Was it the escape lion?
Really show their hands. Yeah.
They had a lion they were hunting down at some point.
It was wolves eating kangaroos.
Wolves. My word. Oh, the wolves eating kangaroos.
For every great story coming out of Belgium, I have the feeling there's like 9 other ones that just are shrouded in the mists of oral tradition and yeah.
Do you think perhaps it's the dust that's kicked up every time the Germans come through?
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
they're playing everything close to the chest.
Yeah. And speaking of the dust of war near I had it and I lost it.
I screwed it up for you because I knew what you were doing.
I was so close. Why don't you just take it from here? Because I'll never recover it.
I know. I'm such a petty man.
All right. It was good.
Chocolate dust, chocolate snow dusts Swiss town after factory malfunction. So this is a Fox News article, and it's basically about, I guess, in this town in Switzerland, the town of Olten, between Zurich and Basel, there was a ventilation malfunction at the lint factory, and basically chocolate rained down or snowed down on the town and kind of covered the surface of everything in a fine layer of chocolate powder.
Oh, my word.
And if it's Lindt, then it's a pretty good chocolate, right? Like, this is premium chocolate.
High
like,
fat, a little bit of sugar. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Did you die and go to heaven? I think that this is my picture of paradise.
Yes.
It's a Willy Wonka chocolate factory, really.
Yeah.
That is a dream of mine. I used to think that you would walk around in heaven with the taste of melting M&Ms on your tongue at all times.
Yes.
Because it's just so wonderful a feeling.
When part of me thinks like malfunction or like the greatest invention ever, this could put this town on the map, right? Like, imagine if you just kept doing that, like, it'd be interesting.
I'm looking at some of the Twitter responses to it.
Well, and that's why I picked this article, was just for the Twitter responses. They just said, like, my favorite was where someone said, "Finally, the turn we were hoping for in 2020."
Perfect. Oh, what a sweet story. Oh, my goodness.
So it's just a fun little story that every once in a while, you know, it snows chocolate.
You do. You have to. That's one of those where you read it and you pause for just a second and remember that life. As we earlier remarked, it does go on, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ah. Yeah.
I bet Tom Bombadil somewhere was like, "I'm going to make it rain chocolate in Switzerland."
And that is just right. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Tasty.
Well,
yeah. There's no getting from that.
No, because we're going to make a shift to dead not silence.
Not even me. You know what reminds me of Mario? The awkward dead silence.
Well, wait, let me try. Actually, So as we know, Switzerland is... is one of those great places where they have never been at war, yet they're always prepared for battle. And here Mario is getting a battle royale game called Super Mario Brothers 35.
35, yeah. Apparently I've been out of the loop for a little while.
Yeah, I quit after 4.
I remember Mario 3 and everyone freaking out about it in the Wizard. But yeah, between then and now, apparently 35. So basically what this story is, it's the 35th anniversary of the original Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, am I that old? I thought,
let's make Dave feel real old. So it's such a fascinating thing to talk about Mario, right? Because Mario is probably one of the most bizarre and dumb Salvador Dali-esque ideas for a video game, and yet there's just something so compelling about it. Like, it's so weird. Like, what is it? It's a Italian plumber eating mushrooms and mutating and jumping on vicious turtles. Like, I mean, it makes no sense at all, but it's just fun, right? The gameplay, I think Mario proves that first rule of video games, that gameplay trumps everything else, right?
Yeah, who wrote Alice in Wonderland? That's what it really is kind of getting after. What's his name? I can't even remember.
Carroll or?
Oh, yeah. Lewis Carroll or Carroll Lewis.
Lewis Carroll.
Yeah, that's that. When you described him like that, this Italian plumber eating mushrooms, growing bigger, growing smaller, and fighting turtles? It sounds like a scene right out of, like, you know, sort of like a discarded scene. But Salvador Dali is good too. Roald Dahl, since we've already gotten him what a bizarre mashup of images and gameplay, because it's just a platforming game, really, when it comes right down to it.
Yeah,
but it's
fun.
It's the par excellence, right?
It's so much fun.
Because who doesn't hear that music and then immediately pick up the controller and play for a while?
Oh yeah.
And how many games are like that?
Yeah, not many, right? Like, even I'm amazed, like, I'll play sometimes on my NES Classic and we'll play, or like, even I have like a Sega version of this too, where it has all of the games. And there's so many games you turn on and you're like, this is just garbage. Like, I can't, like, and these are like supposed to be like the best of the best, but they're just not fun to play. But Mario, any incarnation, you just throw it on and it's just fun. Like, it's just, there's something to it. And it's just, it's the jumping. It's so simple. It's just, I don't know. There's just something about Mario. So it's a great game.
Yeah. What is this? What is this variation, though? It's
kind of so this variation looks really cool. So in the Kotaku article, they show how it's going to look, apparently. And it's like all this crazy. It's like Mario, but on steroids, like with all the modern computing power you could have. And so it's the original Mario, but it looks like they've souped it up. It looks like they've added a ton of extra baddies and a ton of extra points you can get. And so the idea is, I believe, is that you will have 35 people playing against each other in kind of a not cooperative. What's the other of cooperative?
But it's competition.
Yeah, it's like competition mode. And so it will be like the Wizard, but a lot more going on at once. And you know, Lucas will surely win this time. But no, it looks really cool. So it's like the idea is you have 35 people playing Mario against each other, and whoever gets the most points wins, which will finally make some use out of the points in Mario.
Oh, that's right.
Because the points always seem kind of like, so what? Like, it's just sort of...
You didn't get anything from the points. You only got it from the coins.
Yeah, I was just kind of like, oh, okay, I guess I got points. Like, so, I mean, I guess theoretically the goal is to keep playing until you get more and more points. But no, this looks interesting. And so it's released for the 35th anniversary, and it's going to be this... I imagine there's going to be some great competition, and we'll see who in Korea is best at it. That's just a statement based on the numbers, folks.
It is really actually.
I'm sorry.
Well, it's kind of like the Chinese kids farming in WoW.
If you
need help farming, you just go to the Chinese kid.
And yeah. I'm sure it's just a form of envy. So that it was meant only in a positive light.
Sure.
This is going to be online. They said March until. I don't know. They're going to launch it October 1st, but it's only going to be up until March 31st.
Now, what an interesting variation itself. It's the availability is limited.
Yeah.
What's and up with
this
that?
This is one of the things. This is basically the whole reason I picked this article, was so that I could complain about Nintendo.
Yeah.
So Nintendo does this thing, and gaming companies have been doing it a lot more lately. And I just kind of want to shine a light on it, because I can't stand it. There is this sense of offering the video games as a temporary service rather than as a possession that you can have.
Licensing.
And to me, that bothers me. Like, I get it with the MMOs, like World of Warcraft and stuff like that, but it still kind of bothers me, right? Like, where you pay for a game, but you're actually just paying for a temporary experience of it. You're not paying for the product. And I feel like that's changing the nature of what a game is in and of itself. And so Nintendo's been doing this a lot lately, where they're offering things for a limited time, and then they take it away. It's really frustrating, because you can – I mean, sometimes you're late to the party, or, you know, you want to keep playing something that you enjoy, and to just snatch it away, it just seems – it seems cruel, and it seems toying and teasing, and it makes me not want to get into it in the first place.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. That is, we've veered again into sort of IP talk. Just like, what are artists doing? Because this is basically about art and the licensing of art. What are you doing? Why won't you let me enjoy your art the way I want to enjoy it?
It's troublesome.
It is. Yeah. And it seems to be really driven by maximizing profits. And as a crass capitalist, I don't mind profits. I want to make profits myself.
Yeah.
The maximization of it seems to me that that's where we get into problems like this, where, you know, or just say, add one. Let's say you're a middle-aged family guy and you just don't have time to play the way they want you to play, but you really like the game.
Yeah.
I don't want BC to come on next year. I want to play Classic for a lot longer than that. You know? And it's going to come to an end. And I noticed that, like, this is the argument that a lot of people are making about Bethesda. They're not going to make any more Fallout 4s. They're not going to make any more Elder Scrolls standalone games. They're just doing patch releases to their MMOs, versions of them.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's really disappointing. I think that's hurting the art. Because there's no innovation, there's no criticism, it's just the same game over and over again with a different monster at the end.
Well, and I would say that it also gets rid of one aspect of the art, especially the on the whole note of endless expansions and patches, is who is that artist who said art is never completed, only abandoned?
That.
And I think if you open it up to just continually being renovated, then you're taking out that aspect of art, right? Where it is important that it does get abandoned at some point and that you're done with it, right? So that it's sort of an enclosed property that you can talk about.
Yeah.
And for my argument, I will base it almost solely on, look at what George Lucas did to the original trilogy, right? Where he's still cutting up the masters and, you know, adding more Jar Jars or whatever, you know, that he wants to put in. And then he's not letting people access the original. And it's like, no, this was a concrete thing that you are trying to erase now and to modify. And it's just, it's like a 1984 world where history is getting changed and I don't like it.
Ooh. All right. That's
all that to say.
That's an exclamation point on that one.
Let us keep playing Mario, guys. Jeez.
There's the admonition and the exhortation. Da, 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 da. Okay.
And as the heavyweights we are in the gaming world, yeah. I think they'll heed our opinion. That's so, right. Yeah.
What? The Similidudes don't like what we're, our business model?
We can't afford to alienate them.
You know, and I it's just one of those things where I sound like a you know, a horrible, you know, college age Marxist and just saying, haven't you gotten enough profits off of this 35-year-old game? You know, who am I to say? But at the same time, it's just like, haven't you? There's a moral question behind it. Haven't you? You have, haven't you? And it's just, it's a conversation you have to have in a different world, I think. Alas, yeah. And alack, we weep for loss. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that was pretty overwrought. I have my own overwrought thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, what was it again? Let me look at it.
Yeah, lay it on me.
Speaking of which, like the Battle Royale, and this is going to be the same thing when you're playing against 34 other people. It's video games, in a large part, have as a goal to excite primal behavior. You have to kill this existential threat, right? There's never really reasoning and coming to peace with the monster at the end of the cavern. You generally have to bring a big weapon or a team of people with big weapons in order to destroy this being. It's probably just minding itself. And oh, sure, there's a little corruption in the forest. Oh, the rabbits are kind of violent. Big deal. If you left it alone, it'd probably get along just fine. And the crops would grow. And you'd have to give a few to the, you know, almost as a tithe to the big monster at the end. But no, we get excited about killing. And these are base primal behaviors. But they're unfulfilled in general. Like in an MMO, the reason I came up with this was someone was remarking about the economy in an MMORPG. And I've remarked earlier on this program, or actually in this podcast series, that it's not really an economy. It's a commodities market. There is no innovation. There's no better way to mine. There's no better cloth magical robe. It's basically you have a set amount of material and commodities and you go get them and then you put them for sale or you create out of it the fixed number of things you can make. And then he said something like, if only the world's economy could be this predictable. And I just thought immediately, well, in the world's economy, you cannot, in the MMO economy, you cannot kill. And the objection is, of course, well, yeah, you can. Well, no, I'm not dead for real. I basically have to go to a different spot on the map and work my way back to the place where you reduced my HP to zero, right? And then I resurrect and it's too late. You've got the commodity and you've gone to the auction house and sold it. It's not like in real life where you do capture an oil field and you kill literally people to hold on to it. That's why I wonder if we excite this primal behavior in ourselves, we might want to be careful with video games and step away for a little while, read a book, look into the sky, and wait for Tom Bombadil to speak, perhaps.
I think the other problem with video game economics in comparison The only way you could really compare it is if you had an MMO that was very long. But I think we often forget that economic realities have been shaped by families and centuries.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's so much disparity in our economics. Now, to sound like a college Marxist,
yeah,
there's so much disparity. But it really is true. If you look at like the super rich or like even just the countries of the world and how they're laid out economically, it's like there is so much disparity. And it took a long time to get to that point, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like with video games, everyone is still starting out at such a stage that there is actually quite a bit more equality usually in games than there is in the real world. But I feel like if you added that length of time to it, you would see it where there'd be basically like cabals on, you know, certain materials you need for potions and whatnot.
Well, that actually happened in the World of Warcraft. In our server, there was a couple of guilds who cornered the Black Lotus market and artificially jacked up the price. And then Blizzard came and changed the coding. But those guilds mm-hmm. have gotten very rich in a very short amount of time. And I think yeah. they're doing it now. They're sending out guys as basically as drones to collect because Anchorage just opened. I'm all in. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, and you can see that they're always the same name guild that are touring the spots with all the in-game materials, and it's becoming a stress on the auction house right now. But you can't do that in the world. You can't yeah. just have somebody reset the coding. The oil fields are where they are.
Yeah.
You know, and it can't work that way. I like that. I didn't really recognize that in the world – economies are ancient,
yeah,
and they've built over time and been destroyed over time too.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
War and all that, and the occasional earthquake.
But usually, they never get reset.
Yeah,
they only get acquired, right?
Yeah.
So it's like there's no such thing as a real revolution, right? Where there's redistribution, there's just always acquisition.
That's why the world goes crazy. The market, oil market, always goes crazy when there's a little the hint of unrest in Saudi Arabia or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, it just isn't the same, I guess.
Yeah.
And you can't wish for it, but I feel like the desire is excited in us, and I'm using that excited word, and that's the thing I'm concerned about, even in myself when I go do my thing in the video game, and I've acquired so much, and I turn it off to go to bed, and I realize that in my real life I have just wasted time to acquire in real life. So it's a whole different acquisition process. And then the whole notion of morals, should I be spending so much time worrying about acquiring in real life, and shouldn't I be content and grateful for what I have and, you know, play my video game and enjoy that? So on and so forth. So I don't know. That's overwrought, isn't it? Isn't that what the segment is?
Oh, yeah. That's the purpose. You have fulfilled the assignment's requirements.
Absolutely. So that means we move on to the dying embers of the campfire, and we consider a few of the songs of yore that we enjoyed. And I have a kind of a variation on the guest name that tune thing for you today.
Sure.
It's still – I hope it's still as frustrating as the other one, but there's not as much at stake. But I thought I would change it up a little bit. Instead of just trying to guess from a hint and maybe from a broad hint or something like that, to actually give you lyrics and have you riff on the lyrics, because I think it'd be fun to listen to you kind of go off on these. Now, these are all songs – I don't think we've done any of these, but maybe one – of these, but these are all songs that you have heard since the early 80s. I keep forgetting when you were born. You were born in the mid 80s, right?
87? Basically, yeah. Close enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've heard these. Anybody who's listening to it today has heard these songs played on the radio, on retro TV, TV shows that are looking back at the 80s, and at the grocery store and at the mall. It doesn't matter. You have heard these songs on a number of occasions, and sometimes they were – well, let's just go. So here I'm going to give you the first line of a song, and when you guess it, you win prizes, and I'll describe to you the prizes that you win. So here you go. Here's the whole exercise has always been about how awful these great songs and how awful the words are and how addicted we are really to the groove.
Yeah.
So this is the lyric, the first lyric that you hear from this song, very famous song. And you can dance for inspiration. Come on, I'm waiting. First of all, what do you think of that poetry?
You can who wrote dance that? For inspiration.
Yeah, and you well, can dance for inspiration. Here, I'll even copy and paste it to you so you can actually look at it because it's
so
memorable a tune, right?
I imagine this is describing, you know, the practice of the whirling dervishes, right? So, you know, you have dancing as a part of your mystical inspiration, where you are spinning around and experiencing the world and changing the world. No, this is total ridiculousness.
What?
This is the type of vapid nonsense that only Madonna could spew out.
Oh boy, howdy.
You can dance for inspiration. Come on, I'm waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's also there's far too much of an I-thou relationship in 80s music. You know, like they're not telling a story. What's the
Kierkegaard lives?
What is the purpose of a song, right? It is not to reach out to some other person. It's to describe the great deeds, you know?
To
tell of great men, to memorialize the great acts of Belgium and other countries, right? This is the purpose of music. And now suddenly we have a shift to, no, music is me reaching out in some geistly way through the radio to you.
Sure.
And I don't know you, and we have no relationship.
But when you're 13, you can call up the radio station and have this dedicated to the girl you really want to dance with.
It is true. Yeah. Delilah would disagree with me fiercely.
Not quite the heroic deeds done on the plains of Pelennor. Right.
Exactly.
Here's the next little bit of the lyric. Get into the groove, boy. You've got to prove your love to me. Yeah.
So is this Get Into the Groove by Madonna?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I was like, I know it's some type of Madonna. It smelled of Madonna, yes.
I think this is her first big hit. She charted a song earlier, but this is the first one. This is what put her on the map. Before Material Girl or Like a Virgin. I can't remember which of the two of those songs was the first, but yeah.
Yeah. So this is her lyricizing at worst her in flagrante delicto experiences with this gentleman.
Yep, exactly.
And at best, at least they're casual dancing.
Yeah.
And by his passion he will prove his manhood to her.
That's right, because every guy loves to dance. Here's what you win for such a wonderful guess. here's your winnings. You get to take home today, Andrew, a feather boa.
Feather boa. Perfect.
Black beaded rosary. That's a trademark of Madonna. She was Roman Catholic and was proud to show her cross while she writhed and scantily clad dances. And also a used roller skates from a burned down roller rink.
Beautiful. I can use all those this weekend.
Good.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Here's a song, and you still hear this one all the time. Here's the very first lyric, and it is, "Once upon a time, not so long ago," is the first lyric.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a little more traditional. We're at least evoking, you know, the entire tradition of song and ballads. So,
okay, yeah. You're getting close. Oh, already sort of dialing it in. Tommy used to work on the docks. Union's been on strike. He's down on its luck. It's tough, so tough. Gina works the diner all day, working for her man. She brings home her pay for love. For love. You know, you did say a song ought to be about great deeds.
It is.
And I've sent it to your little messenger.
There we go.
There.
Yeah. No. See, this strikes me as, you know, kind of like a Bryan Adams, kind of like, You know, that type of, and I'm Canadian, so I think Bryan Adams is an artist other people have heard of. And the rest of the world is like, what? He was like Drake, but way back when, youngsters. It has that feel to it. It's like Journey. This seems like the B-side to Just a Small Town Boy.
Well, you know, it's definitely thematic of the mid-80s.
It is thematic of the mid-80s.
So here's a little more. She says, we've got to hold on to what we've got. It doesn't make a difference if we make it or not. We've got each other, and that's a lot for love. We'll give it a shot.
Is this like Bon Jovi or Bruce Springsteen?
Yeah,
or
see,
like
that, now you've got it down to the only two it could be.
Or, yeah, because it has that. It's the glorification of the blue-collar worker, right?
Yeah, you're really in on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which one is it? Is it the one who likes to go to New Jersey, or is it the one who doesn't like to go to New Jersey? And let's give you the nut here. I got to find you again. I lost track of you. Here you are. Here's the nut. Whoa, we're halfway there.
Oh, living on a prayer.
Yeah, so it kind of fulfills your desire for, like you said, for the great deeds of man. It's not the I and L thing.
Oh, this is all right. You know what? Despite my normal ridicule of Bon Jovi, and my brother is like a secret, he is a closeted Bon Jovi fan. Like, he will literally go to Bon Jovi concerts and then tell people he went to some other concert.
That's funny.
Yeah, but no, like, this is Living on a Prayer. Yeah.
And
you do this terrible thing. Like, I'm not going to do it, because, like, I ever play charades with someone where they're like, oh, I was going to say that. And then everyone's like, well, why didn't you say it?
Right.
And it's like, as soon as I heard the we'll give it a shot, I was like, oh, it's like Living on a Prayer. But I didn't really think that, because if I did, I would have said it. So I am Socratic methoding myself. Into a denial.
I feel like Bon Jovi's onto something, and I kind of like Bon Jovi better than Bruce, and I know that's almost sacrilegious to some people. But see, he does this song. I moved a lot when I was a kid, an awful lot. I went to 8 different schools. And he does that song that's really popular to the on the same album, Cowboy on a 6-stringer I Ride. I'm Wanted Dead or Alive. And it's about being on the road. It's the kind of the archetypical road song that a lot of stars have to write on their second album, and it really speaks to me, Drew. I love that song.
I think this is good. Like, this is proper lyrics. This is a story about real people who are in a bad situation. It epitomizes the 80s because it's anti-union subtly.
Yeah.
But you know, they're working class. They're all, and they only have each other, and that's it.
It's love.
You know, in the 80s, if you did only have each other and a prayer, you could still find, you know, 6 or 7 jobs without even a GED, and, you know, make enough money within a year to put a down payment on a house. Like,
That was
America, right? Like, those were the glory days.
The little pink houses, you bet. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so nowadays, if you're living on a prayer, like, you're in real trouble.
Yeah,
boy.
You are.
I also
like, and I think this is something you can only do with pop rock. And the rhyme scheme, tough for love, because love is one of the most difficult words to rhyme, especially end rhyme. You can rhyme in the middle, but love, you have above and of. I think those are the only two.
Yeah.
Shove, and you can't really write a love song with shove as it's pair. So to put tough with love, I like that because it works as a pair already, because we have the phrase tough love.
Yes.
And then to pair it up in a poem like this, I don't know. We're analyzing a Bon Jovi song.
I think it deserves. It has more merit than most of the lyrics we look at.
It does. So. And so for your good work here, here's what you get to take home. You get a case of Aquanet hairspray.
Yay!
You get a used pyrotechnics tube from the from stage front. And you get a pallet of bricks from a collapsed steel factory.
See, that's good. The kids can make a fort in the backyard.
Congratulations. Yeah. Or maybe a rink that they can use.
Yeah,
the smoke-smelling roller skates, the smoke damage.
Yeah.
Well, here's your third one, and I think you'll enjoy this one. I don't know that this one's at the – it is at the grocery store where we are, but we live in sort of blue-collar America here at the edge of Buffalo. There's a lot of 60s, 70s.
There's a lot of closed steel mills with
I mean, Bethlehem Steel, a whole lot of – yeah, and so a whole lot of people who worked in the factory. And so we hear a lot of this 80s music at the grocery store, right? So here's here it is. Let me kind of get it formatted for you here. I remember going down to a friend of mine's house and he had it, and it was very naughty that he had this album. And my dad would have killed me if he knew I went down to listen to it at my, he was older. He was 11. I was only 9. Now listen up. She's razor sharp. If she don't get her way, she'll slice you apart. Now she's a cool, cool black. She moves like a cat. If you don't get her name, well, you might not make it back. Those are some interesting lyrics.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in on you here. This band in particular, and this sound, it belongs to a whole genre of sound that came out in the 80s, had a meanness to it to me that I didn't like even as a kid. When I would listen to this music, I didn't like it. It was just mean. It wasn't angry. And I liked angry music because of all the schools I went to. But this was mean. I never, ever really liked it.
This is not like grunge. These are like the bullies in the school who beat up the kids who became grunge musicians.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is, you've nailed it, because this is definitely pre-grunge and this is pre-emo. Punk rock was just really starting to come along at the same time in America. I mean, punk rock was a 70s phenomenon in England. And maybe New York City, but the American punk rock scene was just really starting to cook. So you got it, I think.
Yeah. So I don't know the artist, but I can tell you that they're describing Perseus's descent to, you know, behead Medusa, because she is razor sharp, and you know, if she doesn't get her way, you're gonna be in real trouble. And you know, she moves like a cat. Definitely agility is why he had to use that shield to, you know, protect himself and look around corners and whatnot. But you know, you might not make it back. And of course he did, and was immortalized in great art like this song.
I've never loved you more than I do right now. I can't believe you did that with this, because when you hear the next lyrics and you know this, you'll know the song. This is
I have no idea what this
is. The incredible connection you have made. You are the platonic ideal of Similitude. How you drew these two unlike things together. She's got the looks that kill, that kill. She's got the looks that kill, that kill. She's got the look. Obviously, this is
it's clearly never been appreciated for the homage
but it
to
is.
Greek mythology that it is.
It actually is. It's these high school dropouts who put together this. You know the song by now?
I don't, honestly. That's the embarrassing thing.
Well, it's a Motley Crue, Looks That Kill.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and I think some of these things too, like, it's like you said, where we're carried along by the tune, where a lot of the time I think I probably could hum it, but like I wouldn't know the words necessarily.
Yeah, see, and everybody's listening to it underneath, and we don't have it obviously while we're recording, and they're going, how could you not know this? But of course you can't. But here's what the song is actually really about. Now she's bulletproof, she keeps her motor clean, oh, and believe me, she's a number 13. The clock strikes midnight. She's looking louder and louder. She's going to turn on her juice boy. Well, then she'll turn on her power. It's a motorcycle, but obviously it's a double entendre.
Yes.
But it's a motorcycle, feminized or personified as an aggressive female. But just kind of listening to you, I think maybe these guys, these cats, the Motley Crue guys, before fame hit them and all the heroin and cocaine and whatever it is that was 80s bacchanalia, that's not a bad lyric.
Yeah.
But this is very early 80s. This is stuff of I think this is Shout at the Devil. Is that an album? I can't remember.
Yeah,
I feel like – I mean, you listen to the song, it's a mean-sounding song.
Yeah.
And to me, it sounds a little bit – Van Halen had that same meanness to it. And then all the wannabes, you know, She's My Cherry Pie, all those – or Slayer. They all sound mean to me. Poison.
Yeah. Well, I was getting like Sammy Hagar vibes from it. So I was like, and then I was like, it's probably like Megadeth or like one of those types of folks.
Yeah. But, Sammy Hagar. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything. Yeah. I hear this at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
When we go like for just shopping, I mean, just normal Saturday shopping, we hear this song. Well, I haven't heard it in decades or months now because of the thing we don't mention, but oh my gosh, you know. And you didn't get this one, but here's what you would have taken home.
Oh, okay.
Another case of Aquanet hairspray. studded leather pants with accompanying fishnet tank top.
Oh, man.
And your very own rusted out 1983 Camaro Z28.
No!
To drive the lady around. Woofer.
That is my dream car. Oh,
it was powder blue at one point, and
no.
The interior was pleather.
Oh, you were describing my dream house just drove away into the distance.
Seriously, are you a Camaro guy?
Oh yeah, 100%.
Really?
No, I definitely aspire to one day being able to purchase an old Camaro to sleep in.
These are the greatest. I'm teasing a little bit because it's prototypical kind of.
Yeah.
What would you burnout car? You know, a friend of mine was a burnout. And he had one, and it was white and blood red. Blood. What do you call it? Oxblood interior. And man, did he have a ball inside that vehicle.
Oh yeah.
He complained that the steering wheel bruised his bottom.
That is my dream. Like those are that is the best kind of car. Yeah.
My dad pointed me out that once, and a guy was coming toward us in the Camaro, and he pointed it out, and I was like 16, maybe, and he said, "That guy has everything he ever wanted."
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
He was saying it because the kid was probably, 19? And he was saying that as a warning to me. And I'm like, that's not really that bad, is it?
Yeah, no, honestly. Yeah,
and then we moved, and that was the last I ever got to dream. It was just sort of – he used to just make fun of guys who worked for Buildings and Grounds. And I think those guys are happier now.
Well, those are the guys who bought the house that they're still living in.
Yeah,
and all
exactly.
The rest of the smart guys who went to university are – Yeah.
I remember one of the last things I ever posted on Facebook was that it was a couple of years ago, 17 years after I graduated, I finally paid off my student loans. And it was supposed to be like this, cynical statement about our educational situation. And a baby boomer went, "Well, it was worth every penny, wasn't it?" No.
See, that guy still has the Camaro in the garage.
That's right. He does. And he souped it up. He's got it linked up in the rear end pretty good, you know. And that's all he talks about. It's all he thinks about. And it's probably a great way to go through life is thinking about the next thing he's going to do to his Z28.
Yep.
Right. Oh, and the Z28 suspension, man, that was awesome.
Oh, I would love one. Yeah. Sick Transit Gloria Mundi.
Oh, man. I command you to come up with some sort of podcast – or sorry, similitude that involves one of these early 80s muscle cars. Because they're of a thing that's – see, I'm more of an early 70s guy. I would love to have – one of the SS's from the 68 to 72, the Nova or the other one. But the Firebird, the Camaro Zs, even the Mustang, it was kind of down and out at the time. Those were something different and special because of the era, because we're coming out of that
era.
With the Melees. Which is unfairly describing the late 70s, but the Melees of the late 70s into the triumphalism of the 80s.
Yeah.
You've got that thing and the music that goes with it and the Broken Woofer thumping out ZZ Top and Motley Crue.
Yeah.
With the umlauts, the meaningless umlauts.
Yep.
Just like the meaningless of dying embers.
Yeah.
Meaninglessness.
Well, Dave. I think the princess is another – or wait. No, we've reached the end of the castle.
I think she's in another guy's Camaro.
Of course she is. Yeah.
We'll go chase him down and beat him up with baseball bats. And then take her out to the Tasty Freeze. get a corn dog.
I'll grab my jean jacket. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll see you there. This is Dave, and this is my friend Drew. Good night. We'll talk to you.
Bye.